Hello and welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, your podcast hosted by the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name's Owen Dore. I'm a trainee working in Thames Valley. And today I have the privilege of hosting a keynote speaker from the WINT Symposium, Andy Vaughton. Andy's an inspiration. He's a retired anaesthetist who has done some incredible things whilst dealing with a diagnosis of motor neurone disease. And we are joined today by him and his wife to talk through his journey. It's a podcast that I found very moving to record and a privilege to hear Andy and his wife, Susie. And I hope you enjoy our conversation today. It is fantastic to welcome Andy and Susan Vaughton to the podcast studio today, just after Andy's keynote speech at the WINT Symposium. Andy Vaughton is an inspiration. He's a retired anaesthetic consultant who, after being diagnosed with M&D in 2021, has led Andy's Army through multiple fundraising efforts to raise over £200,000 for M&D research, including recently completing the Rob Burrow Marathon in under 6 hours, which is amazing. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
And Susie, not only are you a GP, you're also a best-selling Amazon author.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I was a GP partner, and then since last year, I've been full-time with the author career. Lucky that it sort of allows me to be at home and supporting Andy and spending more time together with our boys as well. So yeah, it's been a very positive move for me.
Andy, you graduated from Guy's and Tommy's in London, a rival university to mine, and you've worked in Wales and Australia before settling in Wessex and then in Bournemouth. Would you mind just telling us about your background and your journey with anaesthetics?
Yeah, we qualified in 2003, did a house jobs on the southeast coast, and then after that went to Australia for a year and did a variety of different roles over there, one of which was A&E. I took a long time to kind of work out what I wanted to do. So we came back from Australia. I went into another A&E job, still trying to decide on future career. I was pretty unsure what specialty I wanted to go into. There were aspects of A&E that I really enjoyed, so the resuscitation side of things. I liked the look of the anaesthetist when he came in and saved the day in resus. I started thinking about a career in anaesthetics at that stage, but I was also considering GP. I did an Obs and Gynae job after that, but I was playing a bit of rugby in Wales, and I was playing rugby with a couple of anaesthetic consultants, and they encouraged me to apply for a job that came up at their hospital in Bridgend. I'd had a couple of other mates who'd started an anaesthetic job, and they absolutely loved it. And then, I guess, just fortuitously got the job and never looked back after that. It was a career I absolutely loved. It was very hands-on, which suited me. I loved the clinical side of it. So after Bridgend, moved up to Bangor. We got hit by MMC, and Susie, despite us just getting engaged and having a house in Cardiff, moved down to Poole through all that was going on at the time. Then eventually I managed to transfer down to Wessex, finish my training there, and then luckily got a job in Bournemouth, where I ended up working with a lot of really close mates of mine from uni. Yeah, it was great. I loved it. The camaraderie, I love working in theatres, and the team environment, and like I said, just the clinical aspects of the job was, it was my dream, really, in medicine.
It's summarised by the fact that on your profile and the Bournemouth Hospital's website, it just says job satisfaction as the number one thing you enjoy being an anaesthetist about. Do you think your background in rugby and your keeping up your sport has helped your journey through medicine?
Oh, definitely. Like, you know, rugby is a great team sport. You have to work together to try and win a game. And I think that translates into medicine. There's lots of those softer skills, the communication skills, the teamwork, and all those, all the softer skills that you're not really trained in, or certainly we weren't particularly when we were going through medical school, that I think massively helped me in my career, and particularly in aesthetics, where it is a real team environment.
Yeah, and communication is so important amongst it as well. Moving on to your discussion about your first symptoms. So in 2016, from that skiing accident, you first started noticing various different symptoms, and then you sought medical expertise after you lost a arm wrestling match?
Yeah, that's right.
How did you first notice the symptoms of MND?
My diagnosis is complicated. I have a long history, which a lot of the neurologists initially were like, we don't think this is relevant. But I have a long history of fasciculations and a long history of unusual cramps. Then I had, like you say, that skiing accident and a rugby incident, which I think probably muddied the waters a little bit because I had a prolonged recovery after that. And during that time, I think I started to fasciculate more. I started to cramp more. But because I'd had it for so long, I just ignored it. And then it was, 2019 where I started to realise things weren't right. And I did at times Google MND symptoms and knew I had some red flags. But each time I would kind of bury it and think, well, there is other things to explain what's going on. I had ulnar nerve compression symptoms. And I thought it was down to that. But yeah, like you say, it was one of the big light bulb moments for me was when I was arm wrestling. And I like telling stories, it's quite amusing. And I like ribbing my mates who I lost to about it, because in the press I say that I shouldn't have lost to them, which they get very upset about. But it was, like I said in the talk, it's a really weird feeling where your brain's telling you to do one thing and your arm isn't responding as it should do. And it was in an arm wrestle where you really go to try and push someone else's arm down. You need that power to come on. I just didn't have that power any longer in my arm. And yeah, it was a real kind of wake up for me that I actually needed to do something. I needed to get it checked out.
And then you went to go and speak to neurologists and you got diagnosed in 2021 at the height of the pandemic. What was it like navigating the diagnosis, especially being a doctor by background when you're dealing with it?
So there's a couple of aspects here. It was at the height of the pandemic. That made it difficult, actually. I had to go to most of the appointments by myself. And each one was more brutal than the previous one. Some of them I didn't think I was going to get the news that I actually got in the end that I had MND. I thought that I needed some more investigations and things like that. So I had a sense of foreboding for most of the appointments, but I wasn't always expecting the news that I got. And then trying to navigate that by myself was very, very difficult and particularly brutal. Navigating the diagnosis as a medic is hard. I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's difficult to say, but I knew exactly what I was going to be facing. I'd actually had a colleague who'd been diagnosed with it a few years before, and I'd seen her go through the diagnosis and progress very quickly. And yeah, just you immediately go to the kind of darkest place and focus on the bleakest outcome from it. Because with MND, there's nothing you can do. There's no meaningful treatments. There's no cure. It's very difficult to see a positive outcome. And I really, really struggled early on with that.
And in terms of that, also being a doctor was sort of, as you mentioned previously, with the symptoms, we sort of self-push things over to the side as well, which makes it so difficult to deal with it. But thank you for sharing that with us, Andy. Almost a fairly similar question, Susie, being a doctor yourself by background and supporting a partner through the MND diagnosis, do you think that makes it more difficult or adds in different elements to it?
I mean, being diagnosed with MND is difficult, whatever. But yeah, I think because you have the background of going through medical school, some conditions are more scary than others. MND probably is one of the most scary, and you think, oh gosh, really wouldn't want to be diagnosed with that. And then I'm very good at denial, so Andy would tell me I'm fasciculating or this, and he, I think, knew he had MND a long time before he was diagnosed, and he did tell me a few times that he was concerned, and I would just shrug it off, really, wouldn't I? I was like, no, don't be ridiculous. So I found it very difficult to accept initially that was the diagnosis and that was the path we're going down. And I think, yeah, you do realise the hopelessness of things as a medic quicker. But obviously, if you're a non-medic and you're diagnosed, then you'll start doing the research fairly quickly and it will. But I think it hits you probably more suddenly as a medic.
Yeah, as opposed to the gradual, as you said, from various different online researchers that you can do. Coming back to your profession that we both know and love, you've got a profession that's so physically demanding. How was it dealing with M&D whilst being an anaesthetist?
I guess at the time I didn't realise it was M&D, but I would question it from time to time. I started to struggle physically with certain procedures. My cramps got worse and I became pretty adept at putting spinals in with a cramped hand. I had a couple of incidents where I'd had to help out with an epidural, and in one particular incident went to put the TUI needle down onto the table next to me, my hand cramped around it. I was holding onto the catheter with the other hand, and I had to, luckily had a trainee with me who was unable to cramp my hand and take the needle out. So I'd had a few incidents like that, which, you know, I started realising things weren't quite right. And then the other thing I noticed was if I'd had to hold on to a difficult airway, I was still really strong at this time. So I could, you know, I could do lots of chin-ups. So my grip strength was still really, really good. But I would notice after holding on to a difficult airway for a while and then going to do a procedure like an arterial line afterwards, I had a bit of a tremor, intention tremor, and that would be way, way worse after doing it. And after a while, I thought it was my ulnar nerve. I was hoping things would get better. But it does start to play on your mind. And never suffered with anxiety or stress. Not that I acknowledged it as stress at work before, but it did start to play on my mind. You start to worry a little bit because you know things aren't quite right and you know things are a bit trickier. But I didn't have a label. I couldn't put my finger on what was, you know, things weren't quite right, didn't know what it was. And with that, I started to get more, I can see this in hindsight, stressed. I stopped being able to cope with things so well. So I procrastinate at the best of times, but I noticed that I just wasn't dealing with emails as they were coming in. I did a lot of teaching and, you know, I was constantly being asked to put sessions on, and I stopped being able to deal with that so well. And I think it was just, I was becoming overloaded with the health anxiety that was kind of hanging around in the background. And then as time went on and M&D started to be floated around a little bit more, either in my mind or as professionals started to pick up on the fact that there was a problem, all that got worse to the point where I just basically stopped answering emails. And I would think I was at the point of maybe having a breakdown, as in I just couldn't deal with the stuff any longer. But that coincided with my diagnosis. It was a strange feeling because as devastating as the diagnosis was, there was a tiny bit of relief in there that actually there was a reason for me to be feeling all these feelings that I wasn't used to, so the anxiety and the stress. And it had been okay to feel like that because there was a real, real problem. And I knew with that diagnosis, all those things would go away. And it made me realise that, you know, as medics, we carry around a lot of baggage that you don't appreciate as stress all the time until, you know, it's a straw that breaks the camel's back. You're just adding in that health anxiety. Suddenly it was too much for me. And I'd never really appreciated that before. I've always been pretty laid back and I didn't think I got stressed, but actually, you are, and you just don't realise it all the time.
That sounds like an incredibly difficult time, Andy, and I think you were mentioning in your talk about getting such conflicting advice about whether or not to stay in or actually think about stepping away. Can't imagine how hard that decision would have been for you, but how did you find that transition of stepping away from clinical medicine?
It was gradual. So I stepped away initially just because mentally I wasn't in the right place, and it was coming up to summer, and in my mind, I needed just 3 months away to get my head around it, process what was going on. I didn't know what a timeline was like. I didn't know how long I had. You're being told all the time by the professionals, I'm saying it's terminal. I was told I'd probably lose use of my arm within a year. And, you know, I just wanted to be with Susie, with my boys, and spend some quality time with them. And then, like I said in the talk, my knee-jerk reaction was that I would go back to work because I just wanted things to stay the same. But after a while, you realise that's probably not the right thing to do. I'm going to progress. At some stage, I would have to step away from work. I think I wanted to just do it on my own terms. One of the ways I thought about it was like a footballer or rugby player, I guess, in your playing. I don't think I was ever in the Premiership, but I was probably bottom end of Championship at best or something like that. But you don't want to start playing down the leagues and being, you know, a lesser version of yourself. I didn't want to go to work and be supervised. I would have found that stressful, I think, and people watching you, watching the changes. And I realised for me, for many reasons, just for family time, for health reasons, so I could try and stay as fit as I possibly could. And that takes a huge amount of time, actually, that my time was better spent retiring on my own terms. But I was gutted. I absolutely loved work. I loved the camaraderie. I loved the team environment. I loved the clinical side of it. And I really missed that. And I wish I hadn't had to go out the way I did. I wish it could have been different. But, you know, life changes and things like this happen. And unfortunately, you have to go with it. And you have to do, I have to do what's best for me and what's best for my family. So, it was difficult, really, really difficult. But now looking back, I realise 100% it was the right thing to have done.
I think when he took the 3 months, I was definitely of a mind he's not going back. There's the physical, he was not safe being underneath. This is such a physical job. You have to, you can't have a tremor. You can't have your hand cramping up when you're doing procedures. And that stress had been causing you so much anxiety. He's such a laid back man. And then he was having difficulty doing the job that he's very, very good at in a physical way, which is causing massive anxiety, and also the background of the stress as well. It's difficult. You're not going to have someone tell you what to do and whether you're safe. You have to make that judgment yourself. And I was much more on the side of that you weren't going to go back to work. Like you said, oh, just 3 months and then I'll see how I am. And I was like, yeah, but I was much more, you won't be going back because he's not safe doing the role that he enjoys and he loves, and also needed to focus on himself and his well-being and trying to reduce stress levels and things as well. But he had to make that judgment. Yeah, it's difficult. You can't have anyone else make it for you.
No, it's one of the wonders of anaesthetics, and especially someone who's so involved in anaesthetic training, is that you're constantly telling people to prepare for worst case scenario in your mind. But then if you're concerned about how you'll step into that I can't imagine how stressful that must be every day going into work, thinking about, well, what if? With that in mind, like, you have got a very unique experience in being a physician and also living with a life-limiting neurological disorder in MND. Do you think there are lessons that we can learn from your experience in how we should approach patients with chronic disease?
I think what I've learned with time living with this is that sometimes, and not everyone does this, but clinicians they try and project their views about your condition, because they know a lot about it, onto you, but they haven't got the lived experience that you have, and it's very, very different. Not just talking about MND here, I've seen it, you know, in a few circumstances. One which I used to find was diabetics, that we would often assume the knowledge that we have from what we've learned how to deal with the condition, but it's very individualised, and every patient is very different. I learned to ask the patient what they would do in certain circumstances rather than trying to take over their treatment from them, assuming knowledge that actually we don't really have, because everyone responds in a different way to it. I think it's similar with MND. I definitely, you know, had conversations where I mentioned asking one of the neurologists about what they think I should do about work, and they were immediately, well, I would carry on working until I could, you know, had to be carried out of the hospital. And, of course, I'm asking his opinion, but projecting his opinion onto me doesn't help me. Doesn't help me at all. I'm trying to make a massive decision in my life, and he's not feeling what I'm feeling because he's not having to live with it. And I think that is, I think it's an important distinction to make as a medic. Not to assume that your knowledge is better than a patient's lived experience with a condition.
Completely agree, because there's so many, as medics, you just want to almost put people into boxes to simplify your thinking and to almost decrease the burden of being able to take on people's emotions and concerns and things like that. But taking that step moment to make sure they seem, feel and heard. Do you think that we can do a little bit better in the medical profession, Susie, at trying to garner that compassion and empathy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're saying that, you know, that doctors often do a wonderful job with being very compassionate, very empathic. It is tricky with conditions that have so very little hope, and it's really a case of putting yourself in, I think, the patient's place, trying to feel, where are they coming from with this? What's their experience? There's also an element of sometimes with conditions that, you know, you want to get across everything that's important about the condition, and that can be your script almost, that I've got to get all of this across to the patient. I have to make sure they understand X, Y, and Z. But also, you can't take away all hope from people, and often patients don't really want you to do that. So I think being treading a little carefully there as well, just to keep in mind, patients don't always want to operate from a place of complete sort of, to be completely, yes, informed, but not sort of completely hopeless. But a lot of doctors are absolutely wonderful, and our neurologist has been wonderful. The specialist nurse is wonderful as well, isn't she, Annemieke? So people are doing very well with it. But yeah, just putting yourself in the patient's place.
One of the highlights and fantastic bits in your talk was just how much you've pushed yourself over the past years to raise an astonishing amount of money for MND. I mean, the list was incredible. You've broke a Guinness World Record for the longest beach touch rugby game ever. You've done a 12-day hike with your sister in Jordan, and you've recently completed the Rockborough Marathon in under 6 hours, which is an incredible achievement in itself, let alone when you're running with MND. So just moving on to the Guinness World Record attempts, I mean, how was that?
Oh, it was amazing. I love rugby. It's been a massive part of my life. So to get to play rugby for 34 hours with my mates on the beach was just an unbelievable experience. And then to do it, to fundraise so much money, was awesome. It was huge logistical exercise. It took months and months and months to organise. When we first came up with the idea, the four of us met in a pub to see whether it was feasible or not. I think in the back of our minds, we thought we would go down with four jumpers as posts, get someone to stand on the touchline and film us with their phone and run around for like 20 odd hours or so. But turned out that that was no way sufficient. And Guinness require a lot of boxes to be ticked.
They do.
Yeah, a lot of boxes. So that came in with like a huge number of requirements and a huge number of people to help out with that side of things. And then obviously logistically, doing it for that long, you need a huge amount of food, physios, tents, marquees, floodlights. And to get all that onto a beach is tricky. So yeah, there was a huge number of people involved and a huge number of people put in a massive amount of work.
It was a big community effort, wasn't it, down in Poole? Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was just, it's really difficult to describe, but yeah, just a sense of community that ran through the whole thing, and the crowds it attracted, obviously the fundraising. It was incredible. Really, really emotional a couple of days, and times you'll never forget. And I have to be careful with Susie here, but, you know, it's definitely up there with wedding day.
Yeah. Can't say anything about the birth of your children.
yeah.
And, be nice.
What I'd like to put into the link is, if it's available on YouTube, is you've put together a fantastic 2-3 minute video of the highlights of it. Susie, did you manage to rest at all in your support role? Because I saw in many of the photos, you were there leading a lot of the different support elements to keep that game going.
Not really, no. Andy's rugby team are called the Sandbaggers, and they have named the wives the Handbaggers. We're not really on board with the name, but
Can't imagine you are.
So yeah, the Handbaggers were all great. They're great friends, and they were brilliant support. They were coordinating all of the food and all sorts. It was a massive undertaking. So it was really fun, exhausting, but really fun.
I wanted to ask you about your inspiration from Doddy Weir. You mentioned it in your talk, and I know that you've done a lot of fundraising for the My Name Is Doddy Foundation, but you previously had a connection with him, meeting him when he was 22, and then he contacted you after the diagnosis. What did that conversation mean to you?
A huge amount. He reached out and he spoke to me about 40 minutes. It was a busy time for him. It was during the Lions tour when he called me. And he was also clearly suffering a lot with MND at the time. His voice was going. But yeah, to take the time to reach out, you know, we had a chat about the Barbados story where we met up in a bar, and he obviously didn't remember it, but he remembered the holiday, so we talked about that. And then we talked about, you know, both the journeys that we'd been on, and he gave me just some really useful insights into how he'd cope with his diagnosis, how important it was to stay positive, just keep putting one foot in front of the other and drink lots of Guinness. But he's a lovely bloke. He is, as you see him, he's unbelievably friendly, very down to earth, and incredibly strong, courageous man to do what he did whilst, you know, he was living with a reasonably fast progression of the disease, and to do all he's done is just absolutely inspirational. And he would always be a huge inspiration in my journey. And it's why I always support the charity. They do a lot of good for research and care, and I've seen that firsthand as well. He was amazing.
Yeah, he's an incredible guy, and the foundation that he's set up, especially with the amount of work his son's putting into it, is absolutely amazing. You were mentioning there that he's been a bit of an inspiration. Was he one of the inspirations that compels you to, along with Rob Burrow, that compelled you to do the incredible challenge of completing a marathon in under 6 hours?
Absolutely. It had been on my radar since they started it, but for various reasons I was doing other things at the time, so I couldn't do it for the first couple of years, and then I was worried I'd left it too late. I wasn't sure if I'd be able to do it, but there were a few things that happened in 2024 where, you know, made me realise that my legs were still strong, I had still a good amount of endurance in them, and I would hopefully be able to get around it. The strategy that I had to do, so the walk-running strategy, just to kind of manage the cramps and things. But it, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to do it because of Rob, and I wanted to do it because of Doddy. Sounds weird because they're not here any longer, but it's a way of saying thank you to them. And, you know, thank you for being the inspirational figures that they have been in my life. And, like I said, they're unbelievably courageous and brave and really wanted to run it in their name. And I used them as inspiration as I was going around as well, because, you know, I've been around a while now with the disease. I've seen a lot of people come and go, and, you know, I have that powerful perspective that I'm really, really lucky to still be here, to still be able to do these challenges. You know, I know they were given anything to do that, and that was really powerful inspiration and motivation for me. You know, when time's tough during the marathon, I just thought of that, and you just keep pushing on because of that.
That is absolutely incredible. And their stories, I know, is well known, thankfully, due to some fantastic feats that they have done. And your feat as well is, I use the word inspirational, but I'm genuine, but I find it very inspirational. One of the supports you had for it was Andy's army came together to help you through that marathon journey. Just wondering where Andy's army came from, Susie.
So it was our very good friend's 8-year-old daughter came up with Andy's army because she designed the t-shirts that they were going to wear, and she was like, I want Andy's army to be on the t-shirts. So it was really sweet. They made all the t-shirts for them, all sort of matching t-shirts with their names on and everything, so that people can cheer the names and things and Andy's army on as they went past. So yeah, that's where it came from.
Oh, fantastic. And just out of your interest, how did you break the marathon down, like in terms of both your training and also on the day?
With my run walk strategy, because I knew I wouldn't be able to run the whole thing, I knew I would have to walk bits of it just to give my legs a bit of time to recover. whenever I've been running just before coming up with doing the marathon, when I got to about 10, 12 kilometres, like, my legs would start to cramp, my hamstrings would go. So I knew that was kind of the limit of a run. And then I needed to see whether, if I walked after that, gave my legs a bit of time to recover, whether I'd be able to run again. And really, I just had to get stuck into the training and see how that went, because I couldn't go into a long, long distance straight away. So it was building up gradually. And as time went on, I started to push myself more. So the longest training run I did, I ran 10 kilometres, walked 5, ran 10, walked 5, ran 3. And that went brilliantly. It was really good. Didn't get any cramps at all. And I realised at that point that I'd be able to do it. But that really helped that strategy then, to, for me, mentally, to break down the marathon into much more manageable chunks. So I actually brought the running back down on the day of the marathon, because it was really hot. So I ran 6, walked 5, and I just did it in 11k chunks. And I was like, I've got to do 3 of those, and then I'm at 33k, and then I've only got 9k left. And then I'm going to run 3, walk 3, run 3, and just take each of those smaller chunks as the next target. And it really, really helped me mentally, actually, just to get to the end of each one of those. It was nice doing the walking part, recovering, and then getting stuck into the running again, because you feel like going slowly. It was quite nice to speed up. And yeah, it's just very natural, actually. It broke it up like that.
And how did you have to adapt both your running technique and also your ability to maintain nutrition whilst dealing with MND on your marathon run?
I'd had to fashion a sling, because I can't hold my arms up any longer when I run. I can't really run with them by my side. It feels really awkward. So I didn't really invent it, but I got a sling that I'd wear around my shoulders. It's a resistance band, so it's springy. I put my hands in the end of it. It feels almost like I'm running normally. It doesn't quite feel like that. I feel a bit crowded around the chest, but it did give me the ability to run in a more efficient way. The problem with that is my arms still get tired. And when they fatigue too much, they stop working. And I can't actually get my hands up to my mouth to feed myself and take on water and that stuff. But so I just had a core group of friends and family who were just constantly carrying water for me, constantly popping gels into my mouth, electrolytes, fussing over me for the whole of the marathon, which was lovely. And yeah, and keeping me cool. I did overheat a bit. I think with how I run, it is a bit crowded. And at one stage, I got really, really hot, kind of in the middle of it, where it was like 25 degrees in Leeds, which is unheard of.
I was going to say, you never expect that to be in Leeds, do you?
No, not at all. I wouldn't have been able to get around without their support. They were awesome. Yeah, just stuck with me the whole way around. And again, it was like the rugby. It was really fun running with your mates, running with family.
And you were saying the people of Leeds were amazing as well, as went through in terms of like messages and cheers.
It's a fantastic atmosphere in Leeds. The whole city turns out and they're massively supportive of the marathon, and it's just a really fun atmosphere. It's a really great marathon to do. Yeah.
Really uplifting. Like, it was brilliant. And you need it at times, you know, when you're going to... There's some quieter parts on the run, and then you come back into a more crowded section, and it really lifts you and just, you know, it helps you keep pushing on, helps you get to the end.
Well, congratulations to you and to Andy's army for that, because that is one hell of an achievement. How was the recovery? Did it involve Guinness?
Unfortunately not. So we finished the marathon about, I can't remember, it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday. And on the way down to the marathon, I'd been contacted by BBC to see if I would come onto the BBC breakfast show at 7 on Monday morning. So it was a rapid turnaround. We went out for a meal, was pretty knackered, and then had to get up at 4 in the morning to get a taxi over to the BBC studios.
Oh, wow.
And go on to BBC Breakfast and do an interview, which was pretty punchy. Yeah, and then recovery was okay, actually. After about 3 days, legs felt pretty good. I go to a personal trainer twice a week, and I went to him the Monday after, and actually realised the legs were still really fatigued. We were doing some weights with them at that point. But then a week after that, everything was back to normal.
In terms of life for you day to day, I know that you've mentioned that MND now predominantly affects your shoulders and your arms. What does day-to-day life look like for you?
I mean, much the same as before. I don't have the structure of work any longer. But I try and keep a relatively structured week just to work around that. Everything is a bit trickier, so everything takes a little bit longer. I'm still pretty independent. I can get dressed by myself, but sometimes we'll ask for help, just if I'm feeling lazy or trying to conserve energy, and you'll help me sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I think
like
you
buttons
do need
and zips and things like that.
I think because it's so routine for us now, and it's a very gradual thing, the help that he needs becomes so every day now you do actually need
yeah,
help.
Yeah, I do need help
every
yeah.
day, but it is a gradual thing. Like, he was going away with some of the other boys to Portugal, and so they're there to support him. I wasn't going to be then. I told him to wear this zip-up hoodie. I thought, that's really warm. And he said, no, I can't, because I can't take it off or put it back on at the airport. And they went at the security. And I was like, what do you mean? Of course you can. He goes, no, Suze, you do that. You just don't realise you're doing it. So it all sort of happens, because it's happened gradually. I don't actually realise that, yes, I zip his hoodie up and I unzip it and take it off. So it's a strange thing, because it is quite a gradual change, but now you are needing more.
Yeah, I definitely need more help. But I still can still drive. So I basically have a full-time job as a taxi driver, running the boys around everywhere.
Well, yeah, with three kids and a dog, yeah. I imagine that is a full-time job.
And he
job
still
for you.
Coaches our youngest son's rugby team as well. So, yeah, you still do that.
I still
yeah.
do that. I go to the gym. I have a personal trainer a couple of times a week. He pushes me really hard. I get a huge amount out of those sessions. And, yeah, my legs keep getting stronger. And I get sometimes I get small gains in upper limbs. And, you know, that's very powerful and positive changes for me, despite the kind of ongoing progression. I didn't get it early on. I get more now. I do get fatigued. So I am mindful of that. Sometimes I have to have a day where I don't do so much. And take it easy and have a bit of a rest. Still try and play golf. I can still kind of get around shorter courses in my own unique way. I've still got pretty good short game. It's just the long game that suffers now. And yeah, and the boys, like, you know, they keep me very busy. We go out and they're heavily into rugby as well. So often I'm going out for kickabouts and things like that. And yeah, and then walk the dog. And then things like this pop up all the time. So I get invites to, you know, do talks in places. It helps keep my mind sharp. And I've been invited to do some teaching at Bournemouth Hospital in a couple of months. And just things kind of just keep popping up. And the charity stuff keeps us busy as well. We've got a big gala dinner tomorrow, actually, in Bournemouth.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of organisation and preparation around that. I have only been doing a small part of that, and there's a committee that have put a huge amount of work into that as well. But yeah, you know, I have a role to play in things like that, and then thinking about the next challenge, and that takes a degree of organisation, and then I'm not sure if I actually help you or not with your writing, probably not.
Yeah, I bounce ideas off. But yeah. Poor Andy's a captive audience now for me to bounce ideas off.
A fantastic testing yeah. lab before your next bestseller, Susie.
But psychologically, also, we try and stay in the now and today and this week. Is it a good day today? What can we be grateful for now? All those cliches are, you know, you don't actually realise how important they are until something like this happens and you're like, well, actually, no, it is, you need to be present in this moment. Is this a good moment now? Is this a good week now? We don't live so much in the future. We're not massively planning for the future. You plan ahead with the challenges and things, hope that you will be okay for them. But it's being in the present moment and being happy in the present moment with our family is what we try and do.
Touching just upon that and some of the things that you've mentioned, Andy, I think we've talked about the challenges of clinicians struggling to accept support and help. From the lessons of you learned, what would you like our listeners to know about?
I think to acknowledge if you're struggling, I think it's important to reach out. This is all quite hypocritical because I didn't really do that, but it's certainly with hindsight and lessons learned, I think it's really, really important to appreciate when things aren't going great and to acknowledge it and to reach out. I think I've got a bit better with that. You know, I like to talk things through with people. When I first got diagnosed, I just wanted to shut up shop. I didn't want to talk to anyone about it. But I luckily realised quite quickly that was the wrong thing to do. And I have a great group of mates. And they quickly just pushed back against that. And they were like, came to see me, wanted to chat to me all the time. And I realised that, you know, that was the best therapy for me, that you needed to talk about it. And to acknowledge the grief, I read an article quite early on which talks about letting the grief pass through you rather than fighting it. And I think that's really, really important because you have to do that. You have to accept it to be able to try and move on and try and get back to a place where you can be happy again and where you can live.
Thank you so much. I think the lessons of trying to understand that and talking to people is so important. And one of the things I will be taking away from today, you've raised an incredible amount, over £200,000 for MND research, which will be hugely beneficial to those charities. What are your hopes for the future of MND research and care?
That more's done. It's still vastly underfunded as a disease where there is nothing. And by that, I know there's a couple of medications that you can take, but my personal view is they're not effective. They're not meaningful treatments at all. There's certainly no cure. There is hopefully stuff on the horizon. Always keep hope that there will be something. I think some of the gene therapies coming through give the community a bit more hope that there might be a breakthrough at some point in the future. But it's a pretty desperate place. It's a devastating diagnosis. There's no hope at the moment. And until there is actually something concrete, all the noise for me is meaningless. It actually needs to be a medication that is effective either in slowing down progression or hopefully a cure. But until that is actively available, you know, this might sound a bit brutal, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I want to see something there. But it's going to require a huge amount more fundraising, a huge amount of more money to be able to fund these breakthroughs, and that's so important.
Thank you, and I know that you are so active, and I think loads of people will hear your story of how you have just so gone after fundraising that they will be inspired to do their own bits. But I know that we've mentioned previously that there might be another challenge on the horizon. Can we get any previews?
Well, so hoping to do a continuous 100-kilometre hike around the Jurassic Coast. It's a Jurassic Ultra walk. Signed up as Andy's Army, raising money for My Name's Dolly Foundation again. And I can give you the link if you want.
Oh, yeah, please, because I was just my next question was going to be, like, how can we, for the listeners who are inspired by your story, how can they help out? We'll put the link into that incredible fundraising activity into the bio.
Brilliant, thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so much for coming in today and being so open with us, Andy and Susie. I feel emotional just from interviewing you guys. So thank you. And it's been an amazing talk and an amazing episode to be part of. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you to the listener for joining us on the discussion of Andy and Susie's journey with MND. I'd like to ask you to share the story with anyone that you think would find the journey they've been on inspiring. Please do look at a link in the bio. We'll have lots in there, including Andy's rugby game in Bournemouth. And lastly, I'd like to ask you to subscribe to Anesthesia On Air for more podcasts like this. Thank you so much.